Well, there's no simple answer, so I think we are as ready as we're going to be.
Yeah, I agree. Let's do
Don't sound too excited. All
it.
right, let's cue the music, Abram. Welcome to the Radical Bureaucrat Podcast, the podcast for people trying to change institutions from the inside.
That's right. Today is part two of a four-part series on breaking silence around the occupation of Palestine. We're trying to navigate talking about these controversial issues without destroying relationships.
Here's the truth, and I think you heard it reflected in Abram's tone of voice. We made at least three attempts to draft a structure for this conversation, for this episode, that made sense to us, and we kept getting stuck.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating. I like to think of myself as good at breaking the logjam, but we got real stuck trying to wrap a lot of process around this conversation. So I guess it's hard. That's why we're doing it in the first place. That's why it hasn't been done enough, is because it's real hard to do.
And we are doing it because we believe that we need to talk about this. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and so in keeping with our value last week around humility, we're not the smartest, and we're definitely not the most informed people to talk about this. We don't have, degrees in international relations or experience in the diplomatic corps. We're just two friends who read a lot of stuff and see a lot of things and feel a lot of things and are trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah, and we don't know where the conversation is going to lead. Before we jump in, though, let me say that our first episode was the prelude to this one. We spent a long time in that episode making the case for why and how we hope to approach this conversation.
Yeah, so we hope you listen to that one. And it's sort of a little slow, and we don't really get into Palestine and Israel too much because we save that for this episode, really. So yeah, Sam, let's get into it. What is it that you've been wanting to say so much about Gaza? What's on your mind?
When I think about this, I feel this welling in my chest. Like there's something that wants to get out, and I don't know what it is. It does make me think that, like, I need to go to a protest quick and just get out there with a large group of people and start shouting. And I understand that can be a very cathartic experience. I've done it, multiple times, and that's a release for this like upset and this anger. You and I listened to last week's episode of This American Life,
Whew.
where they spoke to people in Palestine, in Gaza, and to hear, well before October 7th, there were multiple like. It was a frequent refrain of Palestinians that the occupation of Palestine is dehumanizing. But to hear how much worse it's gotten since October 7th, the dehumanization, the violence, I've seen multiple accounts, and this was in the episode, of just what it's like to need to use the bathroom, take a shit. And you got 60 people in the line for one bathroom standing in front of you, right?
Yeah.
And this is not supposed to be the biggest thing. You're trying to survive, right?
Yeah.
But this is survival, because if you go do it in the street, like, it's unsanitary. Like, this is part of the slow destruction that's happening, and it's happening in our name. And so I don't think. And again, I'm going to step back for a second. I don't think I'm saying anything different or profound here, but I'm just looking for an outlet to express it.
Yeah, I'm reminded there's a Rolling Stones song I used to listen to in college a lot on the album Let It Bleed. But one of the lines in the song says, I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse. Singing words gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50-amp fuse. And it's just you know, this moment that Mick Jagger is singing about of, you know, protest, you know, in a city like New York, where we both spend a lot of our time, where you spend 100% of your time, really. And I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse, singing words gonna the bed. You know, this idea that unless there's some outlet for the dissatisfaction, for the disappointment, you know, for the heartbreak that is war, and knowing that people are having to live through war because of your comfort, basically, you know, needs to be some release on that pressure, I think. Although if you go down to a protest, I'd be careful because as you were just sharing before we jumped on the podcast, it looks like people are getting arrested more and more at protests now for showing up to protests. Right. And one of the big things that's happening in the city this week is that the governor of New York has decided to deploy the National Guard to the subway system. And it just so happens that this deployment of the National Guard, you know, in the name of safety and crime, when crime is at a, you know, 60-year low or something like that on the subway. But the National Guard is there because a couple days earlier, a bunch of people, activists, took over the subway and put a bunch of replacement fake ads up, drawing attention to Gaza and Palestine, so that millions of people on the subway were greeted by the, you know, these images of destroyed cities and, you know, instead of their usual street easy ads or whatever they're used to on the subway. And so, you know, this idea that not only are we funding and supplying weaponry to this conflict in the Middle East, but we're cracking down on dissent in the United States through the vehicle of policing. Through, you know, the state violence that's happening in Israel is mirrored by the kinds of violence that's happening here, where people similarly are not allowed to go to a bathroom of their choosing because somebody has an opinion about their gender, or where somebody is denied access to healthcare, you know, because of a perspective on their reproductive health or whatever. So it's all connected in a way. Yeah. And that's the thing that I think makes it tough for me, is that it is all connected and it's all escalating right now. And so there's a little bit of a feeling of overwhelm, or like I'm inside a pinball machine getting knocked back and forth with the news, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's always been such a connection and on both sides, right, to Palestine and to Israel in the United States. And it makes me, you know, when we talk about it, there's a sense in which I feel this sense of confusion. Like, why is this so visceral when, now, on the one hand, over 30,000 Palestinians have died since October 7th because of this conflict, and over 10,000 children, right? Like, we all should be upset. And I don't mean to downplay October 7th. You know, 1,200 Israelis were killed. So there's plenty to be upset about, but why am I not so upset about, and I know people say this all the time, why am I not so upset about what's happening in Sudan? Why am I, which I don't really know anything about. I just know that there's something really bad happening there right now that people are drawing a comparison to, and these other places. And so there's this sense of like confusion and helplessness too, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, we're not valuing Palestinian lives, but we're also not valuing lives of people all over the world and in this country.
Yeah, but that number in some ways loses its meaning. We don't really understand what 10,000 lives or 10,000 children means. But what it, you know, what it means is a completely different generation, a completely different next 40 years for the people of Palestine, because one in 100 people are gone, you know, and 10,000 children, right? And children in so many ways are the sort of engine of the future hope of an economy. You know, sometimes in the conversations I've had so far with people, that's an issue. You know, I think in particular among people who are pro-Palestinian, but who were very outraged by October 7th and felt in some way the initial days after October 7th were justified in their mind. And you know, what I felt I ran up against was people who were pro wanted the Palestinian state to exist, and yet were on board with this sort of, you know, chapter of war, of conflict. And as I mentioned, I think on the first podcast, it's every so many years that there's a kind of outburst like this in Israel and Palestine. You know, since 1948, it's been about every 6 to 10 years. There's another kind of outburst of
But I
what.
don't. I. This is singular. Like they've leveled the whole Gaza Strip, and we shouldn't be surprised. Really, we shouldn't be. We shouldn't act like this is new. You're correct. Like this is part of the system of occupation. But this is a singular event right now.
Yeah. And what's different about it is the scale of destruction. Is that
Right.
what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah, it seems pretty extreme. It seems like, yeah, I struggle to reach for an example that's not basically World War II, right? You
Yep.
know, we brush up against Godwin's law, right? Like, how long until we have to mention Hitler, right? Like, I think that's been swimming in the conversation for a while. This notion of anti-Semitism and any critique of the Israeli state being anti-Semitism. But part of what's hard for me, at least, about that is that the anti-Semitic actions of people in America and Europe after a half a century leads to American and European Jewish people resettling this part of the Middle East and kicking out all of the non-white people that live there. So, like, why do the people of Palestine have to pay for the anti-Semitism of Europe and America? Like,
Right.
how is that fair? How does that make sense? Also, in a strict sense, the descendants of Shem, right, is the name of the person in the Bible. There's a lot of those descendants who are currently living in the areas that are occupied Palestine, and the people who are replacing them are Americans and Europeans, are not Semitic people except by religion. And so there is a kind of like real muddying of the waters between the kind of religious aspect of Israel, which is really kind of a misnomer, like the Kingdom of Israel in the Bible doesn't have anything to do with the nation of Israel as of 1948. You know, just like the nation of Macedonia is not the same Macedonia that's in Homer. It's like two different parts of the globe, but they have the same name. So, like, because we have this conflation of what Israel is with this religion that then has this history of persecution by white people in Europe and America, and it so happens that the people who are cheering the hardest for Israel are the hardcore rightists in America and Europe. The hardcore conservatives in America and Europe are the ones who are cheering the hardest to destroy the state of Palestine or the two-state solution. And it's all of the liberal Jews who are saying, not in my name, not all of them, but many of the liberal Jews who are saying, not in my name, because the Netanyahu government is not representative of our values as a religion or as a people. They're an extreme, you know, right of center government that has power and is using it to flatten, you know, the part of the country that has people they don't like.
No, I mean, I think you're pointing to some of the reason why all of this is so confusing and confounding. And I think you're painting broad strokes. Like I would,
Always,
I'm not going to
always
debate you
risky.
on the, what's that?
Always risky to paint in broad strokes.
Someone listening is going to be like, "You're wrong,"
Yeah,
right? And
okay.
that's fine. And I don't want to get into that. Part of the like, we've been reading and learning about this history, but we still are just barely scratching the surface. I also, and I know I'm holding myself back maybe in kind of issuing my judgments. This is something you and I have talked about off the recording, but I do want to say that where this all started for me was thinking about three people in my life who I'm very close to, who all see this through such different lenses, and who I love and respect. And so one of them is my sister, who's a progressive Democrat in Oakland. She's married to a man of Israeli descent. His grandparents on his mother's side fled to Israel from pogroms in the 1930s. And his father's mother came to Israel as one of the few surviving members of her family after the Holocaust. And so when she hears people depict Israel as a white settler, Western colonialist project with, oftentimes with no redeeming features, she's like, where does my family fit into that? That doesn't feel like they're describing me. That's not how we experience Israel, right? I have another very close friend who is Muslim, and he's of Indian descent, but he is always he had more awareness of what's happening in Palestine than I think many Americans for many years. And we talked in October, and at the time he said, "Look, Israel consistently, every time there's an Israeli death at the hands of anyone associated with Palestine, 15 to 20 times the number of Palestinians are killed by Israel." So he says, "Israel's not going to stop until there's like 20,000 Palestinians dead." And he was right and he was wrong,
Shockingly
because
prescient, yeah.
it's eclipsed that. And at that time, I think that a lot of people would have thought that that was an outrageously large number. And he's, when I follow him on social media, he's constantly pointing out the biases in the media, right? Which is a layer of this. So that kind of gets what the media that we get in the West, like our skill set at recognizing bias, discrimination, racism, is very useful, because we see it play out, and we don't have to give examples here. You can, you don't have to look hard. And so I've got these different perspectives. I have another very good friend who visited the kibbutz that was attacked in October just less than a year ago, and met the mayor there, who was killed on October 7th. And his immediate reaction to the attack was like, "I can't believe people are already calling for a ceasefire." Like you said, he was, that was so offensive to him. Like 1,200 Israelis have just been killed, and you want us to like lay down our arms? Like this, and so in all of this, that's part of the confusion, I feel like, is like, and this is what we talked about in the first episode, there are multiple truths.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's difficult, and I've had some similar conversations with close friends, although not family members as you've described, or maybe not as close friends, but people who are very intimately connected with the specific people and places that were attacked on the 7th, and I mentioned we have a large immigrant resettler that we work with in New Haven, that has both, was in the Times, has both Palestinian and Israeli sort of people involved with the organization. I hear that. I think some of the confusion or kind of disagreement, I think, is dangerous when it's so. Did you see the story about the auction in New Jersey? That there was a group, a
No.
Jewish group that invited only Jews to bid on land in Gaza, And some people tried to like register and attend and were turned away. There's some videos online of people like trying to ask questions and stuff and like getting some very aggressive responses. No, this is a space for Jews to bid on land that has just been people have been removed from. This happened last week in Jersey. Somebody could easily say, I really want to reconnect with my heritage, and so that's why I'm buying this land and like moving into or building a house where there was rubble or something, or moving into a house, someone else's house. And that may be very honest, that sort of well, I don't understand all of the politics of it and everything, and I don't support violence,
Right.
but you know, I want to reconnect with my roots, and you know, it's hard for us
Right.
to buy land in the United States. Listen, I can tell you it's hard to buy land in this part of the United States. And so I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity. I think the ways in which that can be very easily used by
Yeah.
opportunistic and what I would call evil men to create war,
Right.
is the problem. Okay, like I don't think anybody needs to feel bad or guilty or something about their complicity, but I think we all need to recognize our complicity. Like if we pay our taxes, we're sending bombs to Rafah
Yeah,
right
well,
now.
and what you're saying, I mean, this is so messy, and so I'm going to contradict myself, right, in keeping with the messiness, and say that, like, I don't want to let myself off the hook by saying, like, I don't understand the history, so I can't discuss it. Because if you don't look at the history, and you and I know this from studying race in the United States, then you come to the conversation like, oh, there's, history started on October 7th. Like, Israel was attacked, and so Israel did a counterattack, right? And that is just not the truth, right? Like, this has been going on for so long. One of the texts that you and I have looked at is Edward Said's 1979 text. What is it called? On Palestine. It's a slightly longer book than that. And it's amazing to read about, like, read from it and to see how long the, like, how what he's describing in 1979 feels so relevant and present today. I'm going to just bring in a quote from the book. He says, this is 1979. He says, discussion of the Arab world in general and of the Palestinians in particular is so confused and unfairly slanted in the West that a great effort has to be made to see things as, for better or for worse, they actually are for Palestinians and Arabs. The danger is that in trying to fairly represent the complex circumstances of the Palestinian Zionist conflict, I may not be doing enough to dispel the massive accumulation of lies, distortions, and willful ignorance surrounding the reality of our struggle. Perhaps there is no simple formula for letting the truth emerge in such cases. And certainly I would add that in my own case, I have the strongest belief that the historical insufficiency of the Palestinian cause will finally outlast and outstrip any attempts to misrepresent it. And when I read that, Abram, I'm like, yeah, okay, we can't ignore that. History has happened, but also history has been told in a particular way to slant the rest of
Public
the
perception.
world. Public perception of this debate, and it takes so much work, and this is a work in progress to come into this conflict, even though with the humility of knowing that there's so much we don't know, but still to try to inform ourselves about how we got here. I also, just as I read this, the quote, it's like in 1979, he's like, he has this belief that the sufficiency of the Palestinian cause will outstrip any attempts to misrepresent it. And that, if there's anything that is at all hopeful for me about this, one thing I've been thinking about is that we are hearing Palestinian voices through social media and seeing this up close, like the narrative can't be completely controlled by the powers that be. And I hope, although I can't say I'm hopeful, but I hope that there will be a greater awareness of the Palestinian cause after this.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this a few times that what's different now versus the last six, whatever, however many years, is the internet, is the access to information. So without the internet, without rapid access to information, the potential for propaganda is much starker. You know, the news media infrastructure, as well as the ability to print and distribute things or put things on people's screens, makes the truth in some ways airtight. Whereas with the internet, you get individual people on Facebook or whatever saying different things. Now, there's a problem with that because with that has come a lot of misinformation and our inability to certify information, like make sure that it's true. But like you said, there's so many more Palestinian voices today than there were the last time there was an outburst of conflicts, I think in the 2010s or whatever. I don't have the exact year in front of me. And I think it is the internet. You know, I think the Arab Spring was such a world moment. You know, lots of people were like, whoa. And I think that's when Elon Musk moved by Twitter, right? And like all sorts of things started happening in America. So like the internet and the way the technology has shifted our ability and the speed with which we can access information that perhaps governments don't want us to access, or would prefer that we not access, is what's, I think, making a big difference. I think, you know, there are lots of downsides to that, but one that must be sort of flagged is the effect that watching some of these things, some of these videos has on us, right? Even at this point, I don't really watch too many videos of violence online anymore because it's just scarring, and I've had enough of that in my real life. But even reading the stories at this point, you know, has that kind of, you know, jarring sort of effect for me. So, you know, the day that we recorded the first episode of this season, Aaron Bushnell set himself on fire outside of the Israeli embassy. And like, you know, senior Airman Bushnell is a lot of people's genuine hope and desire for what America's future will be, right? This
Abram, tell people real quick who that was and what happened there.
Aaron Bushnell was a senior airman in the United States Air Force who received his orders to report for duty to a detail involved with Gaza and the extermination of the Palestinian people. And he felt trapped. You know, people have written and stuff is online. He posted some stuff, but in essence, he felt like he didn't have any good option except for suicide. You know, and you know, check on your friends, call the suicide hotline. Suicide is real. It's a thing that people go through during times like this. And this young man, and you know, to be a senior airman in the Air Force, you have to have a lot of preparation and training, ability. And it seemed better for him to set himself on fire. You know, and to die, you know, channeling his pain into screaming out "Free Palestine" as he passed out. And as it happened, a police officer, a Secret Service officer, had his weapon drawn. You know, and another Secret Service officer can be heard on the video shouting, "We need a fire extinguisher right now, not a gun." You know, and it's so emblematic of America. Like, we have solved so many of our problems with guns. And I think we need something more like a fire extinguisher more often. We need to put out fires instead of paying fire forward in the form of bullets or bombs. You know, this is the difficult thing about being an American. You know, I've said this before on the podcast, and I say this more and more frequently. I don't have any other place to go to. I don't have an Israel with a grand promise to my bloodline. I don't have Mexico. I don't have the Apache lands that my people occupied before the colonization of this continent. this country is the only place I've got. I don't have any choice but to pay these taxes that fund bombs in Rafah. You know, like I don't have any choice. I didn't have any choice but to go to college if I had hoped to have any kind of middle class or better lifestyle. And in order to go to college, I didn't have any choice but to take out loans from the federal government. And so I don't have any choice but to continue to pay interest because I can't afford to pay the principal because it's impossible. I have no choice but to pay interest to the federal government so that in addition to my taxes, it can spend that interest on bombs to send to Israel, to build a port in Israel, you know, explain how it's not a colonizing project when we're building a port, a US port in Israel. Like,
Yeah.
it's our project. It's the United States. It's our colony. We're just doing it sly on the sly because you're not allowed to have colonies anymore. We don't have the courage to just come out and say we want to be conquering kings like the British were before us. You know, instead we hide behind all of these, you know, obfuscations or whatever, and the news, you know. We tell news about celebrities instead of listening to people in Palestine who are suffering or whatever. So I think it can be very difficult living as an American and generating the hope to go on. And I think when you're a senior airman in the US Air Force can do a few different things. It's most likely that what Senior Airman Bushnell was tasked with was remote piloting of drones. And most drones are essentially suicide planes. They have bombs strapped to them and they're piloted into the target. So they're used sort of like missiles, basically. Or they go really high and they drop a grenade from really high so that, you know, really the person who's controlling it with an Xbox controller doesn't have to see what's happening when the grenade explodes. So this person who is sitting behind an Xbox controller operating a drone can't fathom and rationalize the violence that he's complicit in and the orders. Go take this strip of land, you know, on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. And so he very publicly commits suicide. That happened the day we released the first episode of this season. To say that I was shook is an understatement. And that's a part of why I've been stuck on the second episode.
Well, I'm really glad that we can take a moment just to honor. Now I'm going to get his title wrong. Senior, what was it? Senior Airman.
Airman is the title. Aaron Bushnell.
My things to all my friends. You'll never step foot in my room again. You'll close it off, board it up. Remember the time that I spilled the cup of apple juice in the hall. Please tell mom this is not her. I never conquered, rarely came. 16 just held such better days. Days when I still felt alive. We couldn't wait to get outside. The world was wide, too late to try. The door was
I also, one thing that you spoke about, Abram, is this sense of not having any choice. And that like really hit me.
The definition of
And
trauma
I.
for psychologists when they diagnose PTSD, it's about being stuck in the place in your brain where you feel that you're trapped in the trauma. You have no choice but to be traumatized. In that moment of abuse or violence that you're going back to, your mind is stuck not on the violence, but on it's trapped. It doesn't have a way out.
And what I hear you saying is that, like, this is one example, but there are many others of things that slap you in the face living in this country that remind you of that sense of being trapped. And I think about, you know, just all the constriction and emotion that comes up around this. And I think that you really express a lot of that just now. So thank you.
Well, I'm an emotional guy. What can I say? You know, I mentioned this on the first episode, the big echo in terms of the colonization of the Americas and the impact that that's had on my people and my family, is a lot of where those emotions are coming from. I think also being here now, being of a generation that's trapped in student loan debt, being of a generation that can't afford to buy a house, being of a generation that's afraid to have kids. You know, we have a 4-year-old, and I worry. My grandfather, who I talk
What do
about,
you worry about?
I was going to get to that. My grandfather, who I talk
Okay.
about quite a bit, Abel Guerra, who passed me the name Guerra, he was private first class in the United States Marine Corps. And actually, it's because after a life of poverty, he and his two brothers decided to rob a bank, which is a poor decision. It's a poor life decision to decide to rob a
Right.
bank. They were not good criminals. They were caught almost immediately. The three of them were given what actually some of my friends from college and high school were given, which is the chance to be diverted from incarceration by going into the military. It's a very common path for Native Americans, and it's a part of why Native Americans are overrepresented in every branch of the armed services. My grandpa's oldest brother went to the Air Force, the middle brother went to the Army, and my grandpa, at 16 years old, was enrolled by a judge in the United States Marine Corps, which is illegal. You're supposed to be 18, but he lied on the forms. My dad's dad, that was my mom's dad, my dad's dad was in the Air Force. He almost got dishonorably discharged because he wanted to get married before they shipped him off somewhere. But they gave him a break, you know, because he had gone AWOL to get married, and they, okay, fine, and they let him back in. When Lozen was born, the idea of military service is like a pathway for her. There's a very real like vision or dream in my mind. And that's as somebody who's anti-violent. Like, I don't believe in violence or war. And yet, there's something about having the opportunity in America to prove yourself as a valid person through military service, you know, so that other people don't sort of question you as much, you know. And what do I expect my 4-year-old sassy Chicana daughter to do? I expect her to walk through life questioned constantly, you know. And so, you know, as I, you know, somebody who thinks a lot and thinks ahead a lot and makes a lot of sort of plans and stuff, yeah, that pathway was something that was very clear to me, you know, as something that she could be prepared for as a child, you know. And it's something who I have friends, family members who have children, and that's their goal, is for their kid to go into the military. And it's always been that way. You know, if you read Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States, you realize that while most of the people who served in the Revolutionary War ended up dying poor and never receiving their back pay, there was a few thousand people who were ushered into the upper echelons of society in America after the revolution. And it happened directly from the military. And it happened in every war after that in America. I mean, this is the arc. This is why when we go to history class in high school, we talk so much about the wars over, you know, of global history, because it's what has in society in many ways. And yet I can't help but think that in 2024, we've probably extracted about as much value as we're going to be able to extract out of the idea of force and violence. And we're at the point of diminishing returns. We're well past the point of diminishing returns, where the violence and destruction is actually hurting us, because we don't know if one of those 10,000 kids in Palestine would have ended up with some kind of PhD and getting a Nobel Prize for solving some piece of climate change. We'll never know. We don't know if one of those students, you know, that died in one of those universities or hospital would have 10 or 20 years from now, you know, developed some innovative thing that changes everyone's life, space travel or something. We don't know. And we don't care, because we want their land and we want their oil and we want the profits now, for whichever people are demanding the returns to their portfolio. And you know, it's the same reason the planet is falling apart, and this is exactly why so many young people feel a sense of disattachment and disinvestment with our institutions, because the world has just gotten worse and worse and worse with each passing decade for the last 2 or 3 decades.
I don't know what else there is to say, Abram.
Well, you better think of something.
No,
That's not a great note to end on.
don't think that we're going to flip this into a hopeful episode. This was an episode about us expressing what we're feeling and just talking as friends. And again, I mean, I think what you shared about how you look at Lozen as a 4-year-old and think about her future and how it's all tied up in this system and the society that we live in, and it's being made so visceral right now. It's just very powerful.
I remember coming home late one night when Lisa was pregnant and being in tears. I think I had had an interaction with the police on the train, and it all hit me just how hopeless the whole thing is. And like in that moment, 7 months pregnant, I didn't want the baby to come. I didn't want to force another person to be a part of this thing, you know? I'm glad we did, you know. I think I have constant hope because of this little kid that I live with. But God, there's another line from a song. Maybe I'll play it.
He's thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. A foe threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your
You know, to bring it
veins.
back to that episode of This American Life, first of all, we do know, like there was a, I can't remember what her title was or her job, but
Yeah.
there was a brilliant young woman who is on the brink of death right now and nearly died several times. She was the first female engineer of some kind, I think, in Palestine, and that's a life being taken. And there was another, you know, her brother said, "I wish I did not have kids because
Yeah.
I'm a man of responsibility
Yep.
and I cannot make my kids feel safe. They no longer run to me when the bomb explodes because they know that there's nothing I can do." And that is the worst feeling, right?
Yeah, there's something profound. And I think that episode of This American Life was gut-wrenching, you know, because of all this stuff. And I think that's in some ways what's bringing up all this stuff. You know, to hear someone tell us, you know, that you shared a little bit at the beginning of the podcast about waiting for 60 people in line. Now imagine you're waiting for 60 people for the bathroom and you're 7 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And you just
Right.
moved out of your family home that you grew up in, and you're in a strange new place living in a tent that doesn't have a bathroom, and you want to go home. You know,
Yeah.
I know what that feels
And you're
like.
fortunate, by the way, you're fortunate because you have a bathroom and you have a tent,
Right.
right?
And
Like,
some people have had to leave their homes with nothing and have no tent or bathroom. Yeah.
Abram, we should wrap up, and I want to ask you a kind of closing question, especially just because you really did go there, you know,
I thought that's what we were supposed to do.
you did it, you get an A on the
Yeah,
assignment.
I do enjoy A's.
I'm wondering what you are noticing about yourself now that you've said what was on your heart and mind.
I mean, I don't know. I want to say that I feel better. I usually feel better after having the chance to talk about difficult stuff. And I, you know, I do, and I appreciate you listening. because that's heavy stuff, and it's not easy. You know, I sort of unloose all this heavy stuff, and then I can tell everybody around me is kind of like, whoa, they're kind of like burdened by all the heaviness. So I appreciate making space for it, and it does feel better. But I think it's the issue is that it's an ongoing. Well, yeah, freedom is a constant struggle, I guess, is a good title for a book. It's the ongoing struggle of it. It's that there isn't really an end in sight. There's only the growing dissatisfaction, which can only lead to more conflict. I think it feels very unresolved, you know, in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. How do you feel? I mean, you got the chance to say a little bit. I don't know that you got the chance to unburden your soul in the way I did.
I don't feel hopeful about Palestine. I feel like as a human being, we're here to connect with others. And I feel glad that you and I could do that during this time. And I think that that was part of what I was seeking, was just a connection, a conversation around this. It's not going to, as you said, resolve really anything. I don't know. I'm still confused. I don't know what exactly I was looking for. I do know that there's very few places that I would feel comfortable having this conversation. And ironically, one of them is on the podcast, which we may or may not
where
release,
it's publicly available. Yeah.
Right.
Well,
but
I
there's
mean,
a sense
that
like,
we have a certain amount of control.
The podcast gives us a yes, but the podcast gives us a structure for having the conversation and an accountability to do it and a way of just focusing in on each other. And so there's a way in which the podcast, even though it's public or whatever we release is public, it creates the place for us to do this and forces us to be thoughtful about it. I also just feel like when it comes to us as individuals, it's really inner work that we just scratch the surface on that has much more to do with what our body is telling us and the emotions that are happening in our body than understanding any of this intellectually. And I think that's part of my resistance to trying to like delve into a conversation on the history, because I feel like at the end of the day, what this is really about is like in your case, this constriction of feeling like you don't have choice and the trauma associated with that, you know? And so there's a place for the intellectual conversation, and there's another place for the emotions around this. And I'm going to keep looking for places to unpack or examine my emotions around it, because I still feel like as where I started, there's something in my chest that wants to come out. And I think that I do need to find some protests. Because I feel like protest is what we have for making our voices heard. And I can't sit with what's happening right now and feel like I'm not speaking out.
Yeah, I mean, I think my overarching goal has to do with change. Like, I want to be a part of some kind of movement for change, some kind of movement to end things like the occupation of lands that, you know, already belong to someone else. Things like the return of lands that were occupied and need to be given back or whatever. And I guess I feel like you need both. You need the logos of the history and the analysis and everything else. And you need the pathos of the, you know, the humanity and the, the appeal, you know, the moral appeal that comes with that. Yeah, and probably you need a large community that's operating within the same kind of ethos, the same kind of values and ways of being in order to actually achieve change. So I think that's kind of the real larger goal, and how, you know, one of the reasons why I I have yet to be at an official protest. I've done a couple things, but not shown up at a march. But like part of the reason is because I'm not sure that m marches and venting in that way helps me to move toward the change that I want to see or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But it does because sometimes when you're there at the event, you know, there's a certain amount of what's the word? Synchronicity or whatever, where like you happen upon someone, you know, and that's how you find your path forward or whatever, or you get an idea from reading someone's sign or something like that. But yeah, I think the real goal, I hope, is change. How do we change? How do we perhaps first invent the thing that we're trying to move toward and imagine something different? And then how do we move toward it? Stop doing the old thing and start doing the new thing, you know? I guess there was specifically with Israel and Palestine, I think things like, you know, boycott and divestment, things like not just protest, but protest tied to specific demands, right? Around institutional behavior and the expectations that institutions respect human dignity or life or something like that. You know, I think there's politics involved, certainly. You know, I have a lot of politically engaged liberal folks around me in my community at church, and they've all talked about letter writing campaigns or you know, making a phone call into their representatives. You know, there's a whole list of things that we can do. And yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm left wanting in this, you know, is that I want to
Yeah.
figure out what the change is, you know, what's the movement?
Yeah.
How
Yeah.
do we get something
No,
else?
there's not there's certainly not a presidential election that is going to change things on this. And
Unfortunately, yeah, no.
like you said, like the political process doesn't feel like a hopeful way through.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the political engagement is less about the state and national things and a lot more about very local things, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Anyhow, we should wrap
Well, I
up.
don't think we're going to tie this up neatly. Yeah.
Well, if nothing else, I think we've done a really good job of showing that we have no idea what we're doing. I think it's good. I think it's good to be able to practice the cookie dough sort of principle that it's okay to bring the half-baked thoughts and feelings. That's a part of how we work through stuff. You know, as you sort of surface, it definitely feels better to be able to talk about things. And I guess I think, you know, I'm apologetic if people are listening and thinking to themselves, what on earth are these guys talking about? You know, you'll have to let us know.
Yeah, I think that this is only the part of the way that we've envisioned this is that it's only as effective as the engagement we get back from you, the listener. Like, it's great for me and Abram to have this conversation, but we really do want to hear from you. And I think this is a conversation where you may have thoughts like, what should we do for our third episode? What did we leave out? What was useful about hearing us talk about this? We would love to hear from you. So please email us info@radicalbureaucrat.com. That's info@radicalbureaucrat.com. Write a message or record something, send it to us. Or if you have our numbers, text it to us, whatever you want to do. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think we've gotten down to the root of some stuff, and so I think we're being good radicals, which really leaves only one more thing, Sam.
Let's end by being good bureaucrats. The views expressed here are our personal opinions and do not reflect the official or unofficial position of any government agency, policy, party, leader, or really anyone besides the two of us, if that wasn't obvious already. And maybe you, but maybe not. This content has not been supported or approved by anyone and was mostly just made because we wanted an opportunity to talk about things that matter to everyone, whether they realize it or not. Thanks for listening.
onde eu mato a minha sede, onde a lua vem brincar. Esse Brasil livre e trigueiro.